This is the William Mulberger interview for December 14th, 2005.
Hi, Dr. Mulberger. This is Anthony Young calling.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
You sound pretty good to me. Anyway, I've got my questions prepared here.
Okay.
And if you've got a few moments, I'll go ahead and get to work here.
I have the time.
Okay. You already understand the chapter breakdown on my book.
Yeah.
So I've been working on this for about 8 months now. And what I want to do in terms of focusing my questions is how the LRV in general and how the TV system on the LRV in particular actually aided mission exploration and support of the backroom science activities for those missions, 16 and 17. Were you co-investigator or also principal investigator on 16 as well as 17?
I was the PI for 16 and 17.
Okay.
And I had a whole row of co-investigators, four or five academic types, and about half a dozen U.S. Geological Survey people.
Okay.
And they were all put on there for make it look good.
Well, I mean, you can watch the film clips and everything of all these gentlemen in the room. Everybody, of course, has a particular stake in what they're hoping to discover, and I'm really kind of interested in finding out how. Well, let me start with question one first, because I'll get to all that. From your experience, how did you feel the availability of the LRV, the rover, on Apollo 16, influenced the traverse planning for exploration at Descartes?
Well, we couldn't have done it without it.
Yeah.
That's the simplest answer. Of course, that's the reason you landed at these more complex landing sites, is you know you had a rover, which would save you energy and therefore consumables,
mm-hmm.
so you could stay out longer. They also had a better spacesuit. So instead of 5 hours, capability had 7.
Yes.
So both of those things contributed vitally to our planning. And of course, the ultimate constraint was if the vehicle broke down somewhere out on that traverse, do you have enough air to get back?
Yes.
Safely.
Mm-hmm.
And so that drew your outer limit for you.
Was the first traverse of ETVA always the furthest point from the module then?
No, the first traverse. The first EVA always laid out the equipment. Not going to be the base, the scientific station
yes.
left behind.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm. And then what time was left over, you went to a nearby crater or two if you were lucky to sample what was there.
Uh-huh.
So you had samples from around the home base as well as that point. So if you had to leave, you've got a quote representative sample.
The contingency.
Yeah, the contingency.
Okay.
Sample.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you grab that first and set it so you're able to get it in if you had to get out in a hurry.
I see.
Then the other two traverses were the big science runs, and they were almost inevitably in different directions,
mm-hmm.
just because it's the nature of the landing site you were in.
Okay. Did you also watch the live transmissions from Apollo 15, or at least some of them?
Yeah, I was sort of the learner during that mission. You always train two crews for any mission.
Yes.
And so the PI always worked with the prime crew, the ones that actually ended up going and doing it. And then they made the backup on 15. Ended up working with the backup crew, which was also two astronauts plus the Capcom that would have worked with them.
Okay.
And then in 16 and 17, Gordon Sloan and I switched roles.
Mm-hmm.
He was the PI for 14 and 15, and I was the PI for 16 and 17.
transmissions as you were watching these things. Did that experience give you ideas of how you could use the LRV's TV system to look for specific things while Young and Dute were at Descartes? Did it, in other words, did from your perspective, did it help influence or formulate your mind?
Oh, yeah, it did.
Okay.
Reason being, as soon as the crew stopped at some point and got off and adjusted the TV antenna so that the TV would work, then the operator of the TV system at Fendel.
Yes, that's right.
Mission Control. He was in main Mission Control. We were in a science room in back where you don't see out, you only see the TV that's coming down from the moon. It would do a 360-degree pan with the TV camera on the rover.
Yes.
And we had a crew who were taking Polaroid pictures.
I read about that, yeah.
Of that.
Uh-huh.
And then they were sticking them together right there. And the geologists in that team would circle features
that he thought were interesting to think about and kind of look at later. So then as time went on and the crew was doing something that we didn't really need to be watching them anymore, we could go down and say, "Ed, go 6 seconds to the right or to the left, whatever it was." He had moved at a constant rate, and the Polaroid pictures gave us the scale to, you know, give the timing of how far to move. And then zoom in on a big rock that ought to be in the middle of the picture. And zoom in on the mountainside where the trail coming down the boulder side. As I hear, what flavor is the geologist gives that contrast of body and the geologist with the sort of imagery team? Those are brought up to me and sent in front of me within minutes of taking them. So I had plenty of time to look at it to come in and send them instructions. And you might want to add into the information that they have on their checklist.
Okay. Because I did notice on these watching these things, that practically every minute of information stop was really accounted for.
Every second?
Yes. So that means you're down to having with all the scientists and geologists wanting a particular thing and investigating something that we've seen in the back room there. How was that orchestrated? Because even the crew helped to fine tune what it was they to explore at any time. It wasn't just the eyes of the astronauts, but it's the eyes of the geologists on the ground in Houston who saw something that definitely needed to be done.
Features on the moon, not as young. go bingo, out comes rocks, and the dates on them are 3.7 billion. And at that time, that was older than any rock we had dated on Earth.
Yes.
Which is a hell of a, not necessarily a surprise, but it means we're looking at a planet that died before we find any history of Earth. And of course, with those kind of craters being blasted onto the moon and they cover the entire surface, and the Earth is in orbit with it, we ought to be getting hit with rocks just as big. And our rocks, whatever they were, continents, ocean basins, or whatever, they're getting blasted out of existence at the same rate. No wonder we didn't find anything.
Right.
Well, now we found some scraps and shrapnel, in a sense, of those older episodes, and have been able to fill in a little bit about Earth's earliest history.
Mm-hmm.
That all started because of the moon.
Right.
So by successive landing sites, we got ages on the important events, and by the time the Mare basalts of the Apollo 12 landing site were poured out and froze, after that the moon was essentially just a target for meteorites and nothing else active happening.
Mm-hmm.
And not a hell of a lot of big things either, because the surface of the moon looks very much like it did at that time, except for craters like Copernicus and Eratosthenes, clearly young, sitting on top of those older lava flows.
Well, the Earth, of course, is still quite volcanic in terms of activity.
Thank the Lord. Without it, we're dead.
It blows off steam, so to speak. It's just, I'm sure it also helps relieve pressure on plates. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, with the plate motion going on, that's a constant recycling and renewal of the Earth, the surface, in the upper parts of it. And so, once you board it out, run it down the rivers and dump it in the ocean, those rocks have gone through that whole cycle, and eventually, now with the plate tectonics going on, they'll get involved in another mountain episode sometime in the distant future, and recycle all that stuff into something new for plants to eat on, and rivers to wash downstream, and on and so forth.
In that respect, no recent volcanic activity was ever discovered in any of these Apollo missions, was
That's
it?
That's right. In Apollo 17, we thought we were going to go and see the youngest volcanic action in that region, a very dark mantle that coated that hooker country.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out that we misread the photos. That is not the youngest event. The Serenitatis Basin fill is younger than that dark mantle. But in those days, if anything was super dark or super light, we thought that represented a young event that did not have time to get that region turned back into the dull gray that the overall moon has.
Uh-huh.
Well, now we know better.
I see.
You had to go there to learn that.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you a bit about probably the biggest feature they discovered on Apollo 16. And that, of course, was House Rock. I'm kind of disappointed that Duke and Young did not. They were so enthralled by the size of this thing that they never bothered to take any pictures of it as they were going out to it.
Yeah.
Kind of amazed me because they were always taking pictures.
That's right. And that was virtually the only big boulder we could see in the photographs we had before the mission. We knew that big boulder was up there.
Uh-huh.
But when you got pictures that are no better than 20-meter resolution.
Yes.
In other words, a normal house would be invisible.
That's right. That's right.
You don't have a lot of chance to go and pick out specific things for guys to go and sample. Well, on that traverse, they got to the rim of the crater, and they thought that House Rock was nearby, but it turned out to be a hell of a long walk. And of course, they're running up tight against the constraints of having to get back and get buttoned in and launched.
Yeah, because that was at the very end of their third
day. They drove out all the way without stopping to the rim of the crater, which is one of the standard things you really did. You always went to the most remote point right off the bat, so you have a lot of life support system to get you back in case you had to walk.
Yes.
So I think the biggest problem there was by the time they kept talking about how big it was, but as you, and it was just sort of over the edge from the view of our TV camera on the rover.
Yeah,
so we couldn't quite do much looking at it. The astronauts vanished out of sight.
Well, Jack Schmidt had some amusing comment, I guess, about that as they were dropping below the lip of the crater.
Yeah, I forgot what he said, but it was pertinent.
Yeah. Were you able to judge the scale, the scope of this thing in either feet or meters in terms of size once they got up to it? Could you estimate the size of this thing?
Well, all you've got is the pictures of them against it, and you don't see the top of it. So you can't really give it a height.
I see.
And I'm sure we asked the crew when they came home. But frankly, I don't remember.
I could read the pilot's report. Maybe they have something in there on that. Because that thing's gigantic.
It's a pretty hell of a big rock.
It was blown from where?
Right out of the crater.
Oh, okay.
They took a nice panorama of the insides of the crater. They would have liked to have walked closer, but they didn't know how steep it was going to be, and therefore it might be a one-way trip.
Oh, that's what John was saying about. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. That's the last thing you want.
No.
You them fall into a crater.
Yeah, you don't need an adventure like that.
No.
Okay. Let me move on here a little bit. What were your... I may have asked you this already. What were your actual impressions of Descartes from the TV images versus your preconceived ideas? And I think you've already mentioned that. It just differed radically.
Yeah, and you really couldn't tell that from the TV camera. You needed to pick up the rock and get it close to your eyeballs to look at the rock and see the distinctive fabric that exists in impact ridges versus a volcanic lava flow. They're easy to spot. All the guys talked about, of course, was Pretschens. They were really frustrating to start with. We started realizing, damn, we blew the interpretation. There actually had been suggested that it was impact breccia by one of the photogeologists working for the USGS Flagstaff. We had actually listened to his presentation at one time, but decided since the majority of the people thought it was volcanics, they must be right, and this guy clearly must be out in left field.
Okay. What then was, seeing these TV images, and that's what's so marvelous about what the rover was able to contribute to these missions, and that was a real-time TV broadcast on the ground at the exploration site.
Right.
Because prior to that, of course, 11 and 12 and 14 were basically, well, the TV camera got fried, I think, on 14.
Or was it 12?
Well, I hadn't been...
Anyway, there wasn't a hell of a lot of traversing.
Yeah.
And the TV camera was just set up right in front of the landing module.
Right.
And then it sat there.
Yes, that's right.
It was always looking in one direction.
I don't think it had any even remote control capability then.
No. There's only when we got the vehicle was that possible.
Well, even today... Bill, looking at these images that are now available on DVD, and the quality of the TV image 35 years ago is just astounding, really. Sometimes you can even see the granular soil that they're walking on, you know, kicking it up and everything.
Yeah, you see the soil.
It's really amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, we were pretty damn primitive, but they had drawing on those things at that time.
Uh-huh.
You know, we just realized the computer possibilities. Geez, the laptop computer today is at least 10 times as capable as the ones we used to land on the moon.
Yes, that's right.
I don't know what number we ought to put in there rather than 10, but I imagine it's a hell of a lot.
Yes. Well,
that impresses me.
Yeah. I'll get on to the Mars thing in just a minute, but for you, what was the biggest surprise about Descartes that the LRV and the TV system helped discover? That for you, what was the biggest surprise there then?
I think the surprise really was the crew telling us what the rocks were.
Uh-huh.
That was the biggest surprise. And
okay.
On their second EBA, when they drove up to the flanks of the mountain,
yes,
they couldn't recognize the craters that were so obvious in the patterns we saw on the photographs taken earlier from orbit, taken on the 14 mission. We were supposed to have better photography than we got. But just before the Apollo 14 command module went over the 16 landing site, their big fancy camera failed.
Oh, yeah, I think I remember reading about that, yes.
So what they did was take a Hasselblad 70mm film and take pictures of the landing site by rotating the cameras as they went by.
Uh-huh.
So you ended up with a different sort of stereo, but you could still look at them in stereo. That gave us that 20-meter resolution stuff.
I see.
It would have been helpful, I suspect. Well, I don't know how helpful. It, you know, hindsight is always 100% perfect.
Yeah. Okay.
But they had trouble driving up that mountainside. And I think the other thing was, we were talking to Descartes and Keeley formations. One is hummocky and hilly and making mountains, and the other one is smooth plains.
Yes.
And one of John Young's very first comments was, well, whoever called these plains has really got bad eyes. That's not what he said, but that's the what it was basically coming out. It was in this pretty irregular countryside itself.
I see.
The so-called plains that we landed on.
They weren't flat plains. They were quite undulating, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good word.
Okay. Did they, Young and Duke, sit down with you after the mission and talk with you about their impressions of their site? I mean,
yeah, they were available to us all the time afterwards.
I see.
As we would be analyzing the photographs and the transcripts and stuff, we could go and get them and ask specific questions. Of course, they were debriefed going through the whole mission.
Okay.
So, yeah, you took advantage of all of the knowledge stored in their brains that never came out in the pictures.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that was also, of course, the neatest thing about having Schmidt go on 17.
Yes.
He's a professional geologist. Like, matter of fact, I can't think of anybody else in the world at that time that was better qualified to go to the moon and do geology.
It was definitely the right decision. Although it was a tough call for the one who didn't go.
Oh, God, yeah, the one on each of the backup crews.
Yeah.
You know, I happened to be at the party that was going on when the crew announcement was made. There was two extremely disappointed people.
Yeah.
Well, it had to be two because there's only two pair.
Right.
But Cerna ended up being a hell of a good observer and describer. And he contributed vitally to the job as well. But Jack would give us a summary of what they had learned or what they'd done at each stop as they were driving away going to the next place. And by the time they landed in the Pacific Ocean, we'd written a report that was as good as the ones we'd written 90 days after a mission on the previous missions.
I see, just based on his descriptions then.
Yeah.
That's significant. I'm glad you mentioned that.
And of course, the guys were well trained. Let's not count them out. They extremely smart people, and they had a hell of a long
Okay.
So they were roughly equivalent to a typical master's degree in geology, but you're a rather weird one in the sense of you don't have to worry about fossils, you don't have to worry about rivers or some of the other processes that we are so dominant here on Earth.
Yeah.
But regardless, they learned their job and they did a hell of a good sampling and photographing of the countryside.
Yeah. Was Taurus Littrow one of your preferred landing sites? I know they were looking at a lot of, there, of course, there were mission cancellation there toward the end.
Oh, yeah, and, three of them. I was supposed to be in charge of those, too.
I see.
Probably just as well when it happened. I'd be either an alcoholic or dead.
Why do you say that?
Well, it was a 24/7 job.
Yeah, I'll bet it was.
If I was really lucky, I'd get home on the last plane Friday night.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, I'd some motel at an airport and come in on Saturday.
Uh-huh.
And if there's a 9 a.m. meeting in Houston the Monday morning, I could make it by catching the 6 o'clock out of Austin and get there for it.
Uh-huh.
So I wouldn't have to leave until Monday morning. Otherwise, I'd fly in Sunday afternoon and wherever it had to be Monday morning.
Yeah.
That gave my wife barely time to wash my dirty clothes.
Yeah.
Say hello to the kids.
Well, a lot of Apollo was like that, apparently.
The whole Apollo setup, yeah. You knew that it was an important job, you loved what you were doing, and as a result, the family got sacrificed.
A lot of
my colleagues ended up divorced.
Uh-huh.
So on.
And people think that it was happening just to the astronauts, but that...
And the rest of us were, too.
Yeah, yeah. I know I was working, I'm working with one of the thermal engineers on the LRV, real nice guy, Ron Creel. And Ron's been, I call him the fact police because he's helping me with a lot of aspects. And his wife really went through it too because he, I mean, for almost 2 years there, it was nuts. And she didn't see a whole lot of him because he was spending most of his time either up in Seattle or in Houston or someplace where he wasn't home.
Yeah, there was one that I kept track of for my flight. And one day I decided, how far have I flown this year?
Uh-huh.
And in that 1 year, something like a quarter of a million miles on commercial airlines, much less NASA's Gulfstream.
Yes.
And God knows, in rent cars.
Uh-huh.
So on. It was always going.
Yes.
And the guys that worked with all lived in Flagstaff.
Yeah, that's right.
And the meetings were in Houston or at the Cape or in Washington. And then the field trips were scattered out all over the West, which we had to do, or we set up to do, to teach the astronauts how to do geology.
Right. I've been doing quite a bit of research on that, too. I have a chapter devoted to that with emphasis on training with the... both the 1G trainer as well as the Grover, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah,
and,
that's the damnest vehicle.
It's an amazing vehicle for $2,000, isn't it?
Well, $2,000 was pretty big in those days.
I guess it was. But Jerry Schauber told me the story about that. In fact, he sent me his CD. You're probably aware of it.
Yeah, I've got one.
He's been trying to get this thing published. If online or however. So that's still an ongoing saga, but he's done a tremendous work, and that provided me a lot of information about these field trips you just mentioned.
Yeah.
So, let's get on with the 17 here. We already mentioned that it was one of the, Gene Cernan told me it was very, very rugged, and very disconcerting to watch the massive peaks passing on your left and your right as you were going through the valley before you pitched over, kind of thing.
Oh, that must have been when you pitched over and finally could see where you are.
Yeah.
You're between the cliffs.
That's basically, yes.
Yeah, and you're sure as hell happy that the orbital mechanics guys got you in the right place.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Gosh. Yeah. That whole thing.
It really amazed me. Every one of them landed within 100 feet of where it's supposed to.
Yes.
Except Apollo 11.
Uh-huh.
And that was simply because one for Armstrong's fast order.
Yes.
And beside that, they landed, by the